Thank you very much, Rabbi Amale, and thank you. I get to thank Rabbi Froelich also for all of his help over the course of the week. This is my last stop. I'm on my way to Ben Gurion Airport to be with El Al for the next 900 hours and whatever disaster they sit me next to, because I am a magnet for freak shows from Williamsburg. But it's all right. I want to talk this evening, I'm sure. Do you have dinner yet?
Or you didn't have dinner yet?
Not yet.
Okay, neither did I, so let's do this quickly. or else I'll have to eat on the plane, and then I'll just die. So I want to talk a little bit about our year, finding ourselves, and I want to base our conversation tonight, I want to base our talk a little bit in the, I think, what is one of the most challenging aspects of Jewish life, and that is tefillah. I'm the rabbi of a shul in Passaic, New Jersey. We just destroyed our old shul and built a new shul. Building the new shul, people were pretty excited about, but destroying the old shul, they loved. Because it wasn't really a building, it was more of like a barrack. And it housed people, animals, fungus, whatever, you know, could kind of creep its way into the different dynamics. And then with a few leaf blowers, we brought the whole thing down. But one of the challenges that we have is in relating to tefillah, is in relating to davening. Davening comprises so much of the framework and the systematic components of our relationship with God. So I want to talk to you this evening a little bit about tefillah and about our lives and about our Jewish communities. So let's begin. The Gemara tells us the following. We know that we daven three times a day, right? Three times a day we daven. I got here on Monday night, or Monday morning, and I went to the Kotel, and I did Kriya, and that apparently comes along with a sign that says, I'm a stupid rich American, ask me for money many, many times. And I had a chance to daven, and you're davening there, and you see so many different approaches to tefillah. You have the silent daveners, you have the screamers, you have the screamers at the screamers, you have the birds, you have the people getting hit by the birds. There's so many different aspects of tefillah that emerge. So the Gemara asks us the following question. What is the source of this momentum of davening three times a day? Where did the Torah, where is the vision, where is this anchored, where is this rooted that we daven three times a day? And the Gemara gives us two answers. The Gemara says that tefillah keneged korbanos tiknum, and the Gemara says that tefillah keneged avos tiknum. And the Gemara says tefillah keneged avos tiknum. Tefillah keneged korbanos tiknum. That's because three times a day, there would be an avodah, there would be a service in the Beis HaMikdash, and within that structure, within that framework, we mimic, we parallel, and we have shachris, the tamid shel shachar, mincha, the tamid shel bein arbayim, the different avodos they would do at night, and that becomes ma'ariv. That is vision number one of what tefillah is all about. Vision number two, says the Gemara, is keneged ha'avos. That Avram was mesakein shachris, and Yitzchak was mesakein mincha, and Yaakov was mesakein ma'ariv. Asks Rabbi Soloveitchik, why is it that we have these two distinct, these two disparate, these have nothing to do with each other? Where does tefillah really live? Does tefillah live in the enigmatic world of korbanos? The unreachable, sometimes incomprehensible, complex, intricate world of sacrificial service to the Ribbono Shel Olam? Or does tefillah live in the narratives and the life and the legacy and the challenges and the stories of the world of the office? And the Rav explained that it really lives in both. There is a dimension to tefillah that is systematic. There is a dimension to prayer that is structured. And that is personified by the world of korbanos. We know when you show up at the Beis HaMikdash, you don't get just to do whatever you want in the Beis HaMikdash. There's a process, there's a procedure, right? You start with shechita, and then you have kabbalah, you have all sorts of different components to the experience of the world of korbanos. When I was in Smicha at YU, so we used to...
Thank you.
So we used to learn Hilcha Shechita. I don't know, we used to learn Hilcha Shechita. And there was one class that they offered that if you wanted to learn like the practical Shechita, you wanted to learn how to actually slaughter things, you could do that. So this Rabbi Spivak in the MTA bio lab, We used to go there. Shh, that empty has a bottle. We used to go there. And he had chickens. And so you have, this brought out a lot of personalities, right? So some people really were like, let's check something, right? And, you know, and other people were kind of hesitant. So I was a little more of the hesitant one. I don't like blood, especially for myself. So I took the class, and you had to buy this very expensive knife and this, like, Japanese stone. And I remember I was in Shana Rishona, and we had just got married. And I was at home, and my wife comes home a little bit late, and she walks into the apartment. And you can just sort of picture this, you know, like they told her in the Kala classes that when she came home and her smicha husband was sitting there, he'd be learning, or he'd be meditating, or he'd be just communing with the Ribbono Shel Olam. And he's sitting there sharpening a knife on a stone. The look in his eye, it's like, I'm going to slaughter something, man. I am going to kill something. I am going, right? And she walks and she's like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm taking a class on how to slaughter chickens. And she's like, do you want a Shana Shnia, or is this it for you? You know, so she's like, do not ever bring that knife here again unless you use it to cut a bagel. We're not doing Shechita knives in the house. So the Shechita knife went to YU and lived in the locker. And I remember they brought the chickens in, and I learned all the halachos and the simul chadasha, and then they get to the practical part. So they bring in the chicken, and I'm looking at this chicken, and I'm getting really nervous because I've never killed anything. And I'm like, you know, my heart rate's going up, and I'm perspiring, and I'm like, really, I'm getting very nervous. And the teacher's standing there, and he's like, what's the problem? Why can't you do it? I said, I don't know. I could eat them. I just really, you know, maybe I'll put some barbecue sauce on the lunch. Say I could visualize where this is headed. You know, like, you know, I named it Dougie. You know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to, you know, here, chickies. You know, like, I'm trying to, like, just imagine, visualize him on a sandwich, like, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, just trying to get myself. And I just, you know, and he finally, he's like, just do it already. And I'm like, okay, you know, peer pressure. You know, so he's like, you know, once you kill one, you could do it 100 times. I'm like, we are done with the chicken. And I put Dougie down, and I wiped up the barbecue sauce, and I went to lunch at Golan. So so you walk into the Beis HaMikdash, you can't just do what you want. You have to have expertise, you have to know how to shecht, you have to be a Kohen, there's a structure, there's a dynamic to tefillah, as there is a dynamic to so much of our Jewish life that is structured, that is patterned, that is prescribed, that we are essentially told this is exactly how you do it, and this is what you have to do. Tefillah has zmanim, tefillah has location, tefillah has a Beis HaKnesses, tefillah has a sitter, tefillah has a text that obligates you to essentially anchor your prayers in a formulation from thousands of years ago. No matter how inspiring you think it is, you're sitting there reading Hallelujahs. God, you're so awesome, and you're so great, and you love the widows, and they love you, and you will love each other. You know, it's like he has a real self-esteem problem. It's like, you know, you're like looking at this, you know, and you're trying to get into, you're trying to connect, but this is the sitter. This is what you have. That's the structural component of the world of tefillah, says the Rav. There is another dimension to tefillah. And when your tefillah only lives in the world of karbanos, when your tefillah only lives in the world of structure, and it doesn't have embedded within it your personality, it doesn't have the avos dimension embedded within the experience of tefillah, then there is a void in the essence of what you're trying to do. I'll explain with a story. I was once, when I was in Israel for the year, 4 years ago, I was flying from, I grew up in LA, so I was flying from Israel to Los Angeles, which is a very, very long flight. And the flight, it was on an airline called TWA. Remember TWA? TWA is where airplanes went to die. Okay? Airplanes were used by other airlines, they would break, and then they would sell them to TWA. And all from people bought tickets on TWA. I think it was only second to Tower Air, right? Which was basically a box, you know? So TWA, there were like no rules. This was before any rule. You know, people would put in the overhead compartments, they put like refrigerators and suitcases, children that they didn't buy seats for. They were like, momish, like, you know, there were no, anybody, it didn't matter, dogs, cats, parakeets, you know, and the plane, anytime there was turbulence, it would all open, and the oxygen masks would come down constantly. So, you know, whatever they tell you to do, you kill your kid first, and then you help yourself. So everybody's, like this, and this was a normal thing on TWA. I remember flying on TWA from Israel, and smoke filled the cabin, and asking the stewardess if this was normal. She's like, I go to the audition, you know, and you're just like, I don't even know what you're saying, but, you know, and this was the, all right, so you fly TWA, but it was very cheap, and so lots of Jews flew TWA. And so we, so I remember flying from Ben Gurion Airport, and we stopped in Paris, and we were flying from there to New York. When I was stopped in Paris, I had what I believe, for most of us, is our quintessential moment of tefillah be'ez tzara, right? Tefillah be'ez tzara means that something's really wrong. It's when you're watching, I have an empty seat next to me, and you're watching the people walk down the aisle, and you are mamish, you are tehillim kuf kuf gimel. You are like, please, Ribbono Shel, do not sit that monstrosity next to my mom, right? Then the woman gets on, she has like six kids, but only two seats, and you know, and you're like, please do not let that tribe, you know, sit in my row. And you're mamish, you're making me shaberachs and asher yotzar, kel mullies, and you know, anything, you're benching yalav yoko, halil, you're mamish, you're all over any tefillah you can get. You are mamish. Anything you could do, slichos, God, even slichos. Like you're mamish. You are davening to the Rosh Hashanah. This woman comes down the thing. She's like a cross between your grandmother and her grandmother. And you know the olfactory inspiration is preceding her. It's like there's another body of smell coming down the perfume, coming down the aisle. And you're like, Rabbona Shalom, please don't make the righteous suffer. I'm such a good person. It's like Eel. I'm mamish. Like. Please, so everybody's getting on the plane, and this guy comes down the aisle and he sits down next to me, and he's French. Now, French people, they think everyone speaks French. So he right away, he's like, so I think he loved me. It was very romantic conversation. But I didn't understand a word he was saying. So he asked me, so I said, look, I don't know anything French. The only thing I know to do with French is I put it in ketchup. I can put you in ketchup. You know, I don't know how to talk to you. I don't know what to say to you. I don't even know what to, you know, everything you say sounds so beautiful. It's like, it's really, I don't know. I'm from Los Angeles. I don't even know that many words. I don't know. So finally, we started talking in English a little back and forth, and we're schmoozing, Ben, and whatever. And he's telling me all of his, you know, Frenchness, and I'm, you know, talking about normal things. And eventually, about 20 minutes into the flight, the pilot comes on the radio, and he says, "Ladies and gentlemen, we have an indicator light in the cockpit that says that there's a problem with the engine, which means there's either a problem with the engine or there's a problem with the indicator light." Which, at 35,000 feet, that's a pretty big nafkamina. You know, it's not like a Rashi Ron, you know, what's the reason for Hachzora. You know, this is not like, you know, that's not a small thing. Either we're going to crash into the concrete or we need an electrician named Biff. It's not a normal announcement. So immediately, even though they have, you know, all the presentations where they teach you, you know, how to put on a seatbelt and how to do all these things, total chaos, you know, erupts in the plane, and the stewardesses are running up and down the plane, and half of them are Israeli and half of them are French, and they're all screaming, or at least they sounded like they were screaming, they're probably just talking. And then the next thing they do is, you know, when there's a real emergency on the plane, they move whoever's in the exit row. You know, they let you buy the exit row now. If you want, you can buy this chus of sitting in the exit row because there's more space. So they move whoever's in the exit row, and they just put the five biggest men next to the exit row, because if they have to evacuate the plane, they want people who can do this. So there's a woman sitting next to the thing, and she's like, and there's this like 9-foot gigantic man, like his head is like in the overhead compartment. You can't even, like, you know. And this woman's sitting there, and she's like, "Hello, this is my seat. I got this seat. I'm going to do this. Everything's going to be fine. I can do this." And literally, this guy took the woman while she was squeaking, picked her up, and put her in the lap of the chassid next to her. He sat down in the emergency exit room. So they get towards the airport, and we're in Shannon, Ireland, where TWA does not fly. So we look out the window, and there is foam and fire engines on the ground. both of which do not look like they could stop a plane. So everybody's circling, and so finally I'm sitting next to, you know, Hans Franz over here, and I'm starting to say to Tehillim, I'm davening, what else would you do in a situation like that? So I'm zugging Tehillim, and I'm, you know, and I had just, you know, come back from Israel, so I had a sitter, and I had a Gemara, and, you know, a guide to why everyone else is wrong. So I'm saying Tehillim, and I'm like davening and davening, and this guy, he's got the movie catalog open. It used to be on airplanes, they only showed one movie. And you all watched the movie, and it was just too bad. So he's looking at the movie catalog, and he's momish like a London. He's like, whoa, Goldberg, Stars, oh, is that eastbound, or is that westbound, or is it northbound, or southbound? I'm like, we're going downbound. He's like going through the thing, and is that what's the movie, and what rating, and what is Siskel and Ebert? Says two thumbs up, and one thumbs up, one thumbs up, it seems it's an expo, two expos, four expos, and I don't even know. He's going back and forth, working through this whole thing, and finally, I couldn't take it anymore, so I turned to the guy, and I said to him, what are you doing? What are you doing? What are you, you're like a French fry in your brain? What are you doing? So the guy says to me, what are you doing? So I said, I'm praying so that God lands the plane. So I said to him, what are you doing? He said, Luke. He said in a very, like, you know, Skywalker way, Luke. If we crash, then obviously your prayers did not help. And if we don't, then I'm going to know the movie, and you're not. So I'm thinking to myself, God is totally going to kill this guy. I have to daven my head off, because whether it's on this plane or in the terminal from a peanut, this guy is gone, right? This is all on me and the Hasidic guy with the woman in his lap. We have to land this plane. It's our schusim that are going to land this plane. So I'm davening and I'm davening and I'm davening, and finally, Baruch Hashem, it ended well. And we landed at the airport. Whole nother story about what happened at the hotel. But what do you see from a moment like that? This is what Chazal call a tefillah be'es tzar. This is what Chazal call a davening that happens when you feel like you're in trouble. When your life is hanging in the balance, and you see before you an uncertainty and anxiety about your future, about what's going to happen, about what's going to be. What ends up emerging is the essence of who you are. This individual, I'm sure he's a very nice guy, a very wonderful person. But this individual, his life is about indulgence. His life is about enjoyment. He's trying to go through life, not hurt anybody, not do anything wrong. I'm sure he's a nice guy and helps people across the street. But his life is about having a good time. So when his life hangs in the balance, that's what he pivots to. That's what's important to him. That's what becomes the source and the anchor of his existential reality at that moment. But if your life is about achieving something, if your life is about making an impact, about making a difference, then when there's an anxiety of hanging in the balance, what comes to mind, what comes to the forefront, is all of the lost opportunities that the world will never see. Because your personality, your individuality isn't brought to the forefront. What tefillah keneged avos tiknu means is that there is an individuality to tefillah. If you want to learn how to pray, you have to learn who you are. Tefillah is not just about opening a siddur and saying to God, I want wisdom and I want prosperity and I want peace and I want Mashiach and I want David HaMelech. And I want no more lal shinims. Those are terrible, right? Tefillah is your opportunity to realize your potential. You have to know what that potential is. Tefillah keneged avos tiknu means that tefillah is an extension of the ambitions and aspirations and dreams of your life. Tefillah is the platform in which you communicate to God, this is what I want to do, this is what I want to accomplish. I'm not praying for health so I can watch a movie on an airplane. I'm praying for health because I want to make a difference in this world. Because I want to build a family and I want to build a future. And I want to impact the community and I want to impact the world and I want to impact the Jewish people. And to do that, I need wisdom and insight and health and money and all these other things. Tefillah is about reaching the essence of who you are. Of who you are as a person, of what you bring to the world that's unique, that's different, that's individual, that's irreplaceable. It could be that the execution of certain tasks are replaceable. But what you bring to the world, what you can uniquely accomplish, cannot be accomplished by anybody else. You know, the first tefillah we say every morning is Mode Ani, right? We all talk about, tefillah is always about the Rabbim, it's always about the community, right? Rifa'enu, right? Hashiveinu, Barech Aleinu, it's all in Lashon Rabbim. It's all about the community. But the first tefillah you say in the morning is not for anybody. You don't wake up in the morning and make a mishaberach for the cholin on your list. You don't wake up in the morning and daven for Eretz Yisrael. That's not what you do. You wake up in the morning and you say to God, Mode ani lefonecha melechai v'kayam she'achzarta bi nishmasi b'chem lo rabbein yis. Where does that come from, thanking God for returning your soul? So the Pasuk in Tehillim says, B'yadcha afki bruchi padisa osi Hashem kelem. B'yarcha afkid ruchi, in your hand I deposit afkid ruchi, my soul, my spirit. Padisa osi Hashem, and you will redeem me, God. Kelem as a God of truth. Asks the Medrash, what is the God of truth? Says the Medrash, every night, I don't know, 3-4 billion people, half the world at least at one time, all of them go to sleep. And we know this since we're little kids. And when you go to sleep, your soul goes up to heaven. And it has a great time, and then it comes back down, and it goes through your fingernails, which is why there's a mitzvah to step in water in the morning, and then wash nekofaser, right? We all know this. So, says the Medrash, when all the souls go up to Shemayim, it should be conceivable that with that many souls in heaven, that when they come back down, once in a while, you would think once in a while, you'd wake up in the morning, and you're like, oh my God! I have someone else's soul. You wake up in the morning and you're like, you know, oh my God, I have Rabbi Glasser's soul. I want to give a sermon out of nowhere. You know, I want to officiate a wedding. You get down. Let's right. I don't know. I want to go and do. I want to kill a chicken. I want to right. Oh my God, I have your soul. I have your soul. You wake up. So says the Medrash, that never happens, and that's what you thank God for in the morning. You thank God that hey, thank you. You know, for not giving me her soul, or his soul, or all sorts of conflicts that could arise, right? So ask them a question, what are you talking about? This is a Kadosh Baruch Hu. You think it's harder for him to do a billion than one? Like, what are you talking about? And the answer is that what the Medrash is saying is that the first thing you do in the morning, before you confront any dynamic of tefillah at all, the first thing you have to do is take a look at who you are. Kishem she'ein nishmal seyem shavos. Kishem she'ein partsim seyem shavos. Kach ein nishmal seyem shavos. Just like everyone has a different face, everyone has a different soul. Everyone's face reflects a different inside. Everyone has a distinct and unique combination of talents and challenges and successes and failures. And the moment you wake up, the first thing you do is you look in the mirror and you say to yourself, okay, before I start talking about wisdom and lasech vivina and all these, before I go anywhere, the first question is, who am I? What is my potential? What is my role in this world? What is my role in the Jewish community? What contribution am I going to make to the larger landscape of my yeshiva, of Yerushalayim, of Eretz Yisrael, of the world, of the Jewish people, of Jewish history? What is my soul? Why does it matter that I got this soul back and I didn't get someone else's? Why does that matter? What is it that I bring to the table that no one else does? How does the combination of my life experiences and my difficulties and my successes position me to make a difference in the world? And that is the platform of tefillah. Tefillah's structure is to be able to give us a sense of balance, a sense of, you know, this keeps us intact, this keeps us where we need to be. But if it lacks the avos, if it lacks the personality, if it lacks you, if all it is the words in the siddur, if all it is making sure, you know, I have guys in my shul that, you know, are like the most obnoxious people. Oh, this is being recorded. They're the most wonderful people in the world, but totally obsessed with, like, you know, Zman Kriyashma, you know? And it's like, you know, and they'll literally, like, they'll publicly, you know, they'll like, this just becomes, and it's fine. Zman Kriyashma is very important. We often make Zman Kriyashma. It's an expectation. It's a requirement. But if that's the totality of our Kriyashma, If our Kriya Shema does not have within it our sense of personal bechira, of accepting God, a moment where it's not about the rabbis, and it's not about the inspiration, and it's not about what our parents told us to do, it's a Shema Yisrael moment that's just ours. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. God, I don't always like it, I don't always understand it, I don't always relate to it, but I'm in. And it's you. It's nobody else. It's you. And it's the you that comes out when you're on the plane, wondering what's going to happen next. That's tefillah keneged avos. That's what it means to be part of the world of tefillah. There's an amazing story that's told about Yosef Mendelovich. You know Yosef Mendelovich? He's alive. He probably spoke here, maybe. So he's a individual. He spent 10 years in prison in Russia. So when he was a teenager, he had a great idea of how to get out of Russia. As all great ideas come from teenagers. So he said that he's going to hijack a plane, because what could go wrong? And he'll fly the plane to Switzerland, land it in Switzerland, get arrested in Switzerland, where there really are no laws, spend time in prison, lots of chocolate, and then he'll make his way to Israel, and this was the plan. So lo and behold, the government discovers the plan, and they capture him and his friends, and they sentence them to prison. And he's in prison for 10 years. And he writes in his autobiography that while he was in prison, someone snuck into the prison a Rinas Yisrael sitter. You know what a Rinas Yisrael sitter is? It's like an Israeli dicka sitter. Good, you know, a good thin paper. You know, like a good, nice Israeli sitter. And this was the biggest deal in the world. People were like, because everyone wanted to connect with this sitter. First of all, they didn't have a sitter. This now they had a way to learn how to daven. They had a way to read the words. They had a way to talk to the Ribbono Shel Olam. They had formulations from David HaMelech. They had the immortal words of Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. They could connect to Jewish history. They could bring meaning and purpose to their experience. Everyone wanted the sitter. Plus, it had been published in Israel. It was a connection to Israel, and it was very precious. So Yosef Mendelovich realized that at any time, the Russians could discover this sitter, and they could confiscate this sitter. So what did he do? He clandestinely at night would go into a barrack somewhere in the far-off area of the forest, and he copied over the sitter. And night after night after night, even though he had worked in hard labor the whole day, night after night after night, he just copied over one page after the other, after the other, after the other, and every time he finished a page, he hid it in a different part of the camp. Until he had finished four copies of the sitter. And he writes, as he finished the fourth copy, he realized something absolutely extraordinary. Something completely transformative. He realized that by copying over the sitter four times, he had come to know the sitter by heart. And he realized that now, no matter who took these books, he would always have a sitter. And he realized that the world of the sitter, the words, the structures, the familiarity, the patterns, the momentum, the day after day, he realized that that now became part of who he was, who he is, the inner recesses of his personality and his life experience and his struggles and his striving and his dreams. It was all melding together. His world of karbanos and his world of avos. Synthesized into one unidimensional experience of connecting to God. Tefillah is the point. Tefillah is the nexus at which we meet our belief in God and our belief in ourselves. If you don't believe in the greatness that exists within yourself, you can never pray properly. Because you're always praying for something superficial. You're just praying to get to the next day so you could do the next thing, which is also a wonderful bracha. But if you believe in yourself, if you believe you matter, if you believe it's important, if you believe it's going to make a difference, if you believe you have something to give, something to contribute, then davening is about giving something to the world. This is not about me, God. This is about humanity. This is about the Jewish people. So in my work in YU, I have a tremendous privilege because I run a component of Yeshiva University that's responsible for community engagement. In other words, YU is a school, is a university, is a yeshiva in Washington Heights. And Washington Heights is a beautiful neighborhood. It's got trees and parks and
truck.
It's got Amish. It's got all the one. It's a beautiful, beautiful neighborhood. It's a sprawling campus with a grass, and it's Amish. It is a beautiful, nestled in the hills of, you know, it's gorgeous. But Yeshiva University is not just a location in Washington Heights. It is a thriving, vibrant, pulsating source of Torah and inspiration for communities all over the world. And so when a community needs a rav, when a community needs a teacher, when a community needs a lay leader, somebody who works in the community as a volunteer, when a community is looking for students to come and invigorate their Simchas Torah, their Shavuos, their Shabbos, their summer for a kollel, when camps are looking for people who are going to be the next, you know, division heads and head counselors and people who could provide that inspiration, this is where they come. And so YU has engagement with communities all over the world, and certainly all over the United States. In the last 2 weeks, I've been in Houston, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Jerusalem, and tonight, in Eretz Hashem, I'm going to go to Passaic, New Jersey. Very exotic place. Also, I grew up in Los Angeles, and I live in New Jersey. Or LA. I tell people that if you'd have asked me when I was growing up to make a list of the order of the states that I think I would end up living in, New Jersey would have been like 52. After like Guantanamo Bay, you know, like Mamish. But I live in New Jersey, and it's a beautiful experience. The bottom line is that you have an opportunity, I have an opportunity to meet people all over the country. And let me tell you something. All over the United States, there are great rabbis and great teachers and great principals and great schools, and all of you have experienced them. And that's matzovim anoyim, that's amazing. But you know what's missing? Everywhere. What's missing is inspiration emanating from the community. What we have is a lot of cheerleading. Not so good looking, but a lot of cheerleading. We have a lot of people running around teaching, screaming, leading, singing. I was an NCSY regional director for 15 years. My family, Mamish, we eat dinner with a candle and a Holocaust story. This is my life. I'm a serious kid. I take it very seriously. It's not, I'm a Kumsitz Mamish. You know, I take a shower at night. I have a Kumsitz. I think someday we'll all be together and then I go to bed. I'm Mamish. Part of Kriya Shema Lamita. I am holding with the inspiration thing. I got it. I love it. I'm in it. I've messed up my kids with it. I'm totally, totally in it. But the reality is that it's a lot of cheerleading. What we're missing in our community is a vibrant and inspired community for it to come not only from rabbis and teachers and principals and camps, but for it to come from congregants and parents and participants and volunteers and lay leaders. That's what we're missing. And that's what your generation has the opportunity to achieve, to contribute. Wherever you're going to be, please God, it should be here. This is the real center for the Jewish future, right? It's a very humble name, I know. Right? This is the real, please God, it should be here. If it's not going to be here and you're going to walk somewhere else, the question you have to ask yourself is, how can you make a difference where you are? How can you get involved in what's going on? You need to understand that most of the Jewish people is off the charts, not connected to Judaism at all. There's a very small group that could do anything about the future of our people. And a very large portion of them are crazy. And there is an even smaller group of people who have the nuance and the culture and the background and the sophistication and the engagement and the fire and the ambition and the conviction to move the Jewish people forward. And you are part of that group. If you're sitting in this room, you're part of that group. And you have to ask yourself, what's your ovos tikkun? When you go and daven Maariv tonight or Shacharis tomorrow morning, what are you praying for? Are you praying to survive so that you can meet the next day? Or are you praying because you have something to do? You have something to accomplish in this world. You have somewhere to go. You have someone to be. You have someone to become. And that's what this year is about. Introspecting and figuring out, who are you? When that neshama comes back in the morning, what makes it different? when you wake up tomorrow morning than everyone else's? And how are those unique and individual talents and abilities going to channel themselves into making a difference for our community and into making a difference for the rest of the world? Yes, YU provides lots of opportunities for its students to engage the community and to go all sorts of places and to do all sorts of things, and it's amazing. But this is not just about YU. This is about the Jewish people, and this is about all of us taking responsibility for our future together. Do not delegate it to the rabbis. They're a little off. No, they're a little right. Do not delegate it to the rabbis. It's with you. You just have to choose to do it. I wish all of you an amazing year, an amazing bunch of years. If you come to campus, I look forward to seeing you and to seeing you get involved. I'm around for a few minutes if you want to talk. Rabbi Froelich's also around if you want to talk. And he's always around if you want to talk. And it was wonderful to meet all of you. Have a wonderful night.